You're now listening to The Liminalist, the podcast between. This week I'm talking to Rodney Asher. How's the film going?
It's good, though. You know, I'm at that quite frightening stage where one day you think it's great and another, and the next day it's a catastrophe. So,
it's like life.
and it'll stay that way indefinitely, I suppose. But it is kind of the fun part where, you know, the 12 or 14 interviews, however many I've done so far, are starting to talk to each other, you know, and it's not a series of separate conversations, but becoming one thing, which is an important stage of the process.
Right. Absolutely. So when did this idea germinate? Where did the seed come from and how did it germinate?
Well, you know, it certainly goes back. You know, there was one of the people I spoke with during the nightmare said that he suspected that some of the things that he was seeing within sleep paralysis were actually, you know, related to simulation theory, which wasn't exactly something that I was familiar with, at least not by that name. You know, certainly I'd seen The Matrix as well as, you know, 100 other science fiction versions of digitally, technologically simulated worlds. But I wasn't aware that there was a sort of scientific discussion about it that people were taking seriously. So that certainly sent me on a bit of a research project.
Was that somebody in the nightmare who ended up...
Somebody, and he didn't want to talk about it as part of the film, but he was one of the people that I spoke to. And, you know, as an idea that kind of latched on to me and wouldn't let go, in many ways it also seemed related to some of the other projects. If, you know, some of them were talking about interpreting films or interpreting dreams, you know, this is one giant step forward of interpreting reality.
Right. So was this person, did they see it in computer frame of reference as a computer generated simulation, or did they see it in more metaphysical?
I think he was speaking technologically, some sort of futuristic version of you know, computers, digital technology. You know, and the idea that what he was seeing was, you know, what was outside of a simulation was something that I found, you know, a pretty provocative idea.
Are you familiar with the work of Anthony Peake?
You know, not off the top of my head, but it is a name that's familiar. I think it is sort of a side avenue that I might have dug into at some point. Refresh me.
It's likely that you would have done. He also wrote a biography of Philip K. Dick recently, but his main thesis, at least when I knew him, was to do with a daemon, as he called it, and this thesis he came up with. It started with an investigation into temporal lobe epilepsy and how time seems to slow down for these people. That was his in. But he ended up with this whole thesis anyway that there's a afterlife realm in which we relive our life. Or even, I think it was on the point of death. I think his theory was on the point of death, time actually stops. And we then enter into these bardo realms in which we relive our lives in real time. As consciousness, we experience our lives being reenacted in real time, even though we're just on the point of death. And that this happens over and over and over again, like countless times. It's a Groundhog Day theory of existence. And the objective of it is to somehow perfect that life or to resolve all the unresolved things in the life, as in Groundhog Day. And so he had this thesis that most of us are in this simulated realm And so who we think we are, he called it the Edelon, is just a kind of avatar projection of our true self. And our true self is the daemon. And the daemon is attempting to get fully integrated into the life that we live physically, but in such a way that the daemon was unable to fully incarnate, let's say. Hence, we have to just keep replaying these lives until eventually the daemonic consciousness can break through to us. And then, I don't know. I mean, I might have borderized it a little bit, but
sure.
That was the gist of it.
That's one of the first thing it reminds me of is the Jack Chick comic, This Was Your Life, where, you know, the archangel shows you your life back to you, literally in a movie theater with color commentary, pointing out every place that you've gone terribly, terribly wrong.
Right. And have you done some reading into near-death experiences and this consistent testimony I've read about anyway, of the life review thing?
You know, I haven't, but it is something that, you know, sort of spontaneously come up, you know, while talking with people, you know, about this project, you know, folks who are comparing, you know, sort of that, I think typically Christian, you know, religious idea of reviewing your life, marking off, you know, your sins and your virtues as something that feels like what you might do coming off of, you know, a virtual reality experience where you might stop and do a debriefing and discuss everything that went down, you know, while you were inside.
Right. I mean, because the one obvious correlation with the simulation theory is video games. I mean, that's
sure.
As in, that's where we're most aware of the possibility of immersing ourselves in a simulation is through video gaming and, you know, leading into virtual reality. And in video games, the framework essentially is that you're perfecting something and getting better and better so that you can go up the levels.
Well, I recently did a really elaborate video game. There's a facility called The Void where you go in and you wear a helmet but also a whole vest. It's a pretty complicated contraption. And I went in, I brought my son, and I went in with a friend and his son. And now they have a couple of different programs. The one we did was Star Wars themed, and it was pretty unbelievable. More advanced than I actually thought that we were, where you go into a room and you put on the helmet and immediately the room changes. You know, you're now in the cargo bay of a spaceship, and your three friends, you can see, you know, are in there with you, but they're all now stormtroopers. I think that, fictional conceit is that you are rebels undercover as stormtroopers in order to infiltrate the space. But being in this fantasy space with other people who I could see and I could reach out and touch them, you know, and my little boy was, you know, like a 4-foot-tall stormtrooper, perfectly to scale, and you could reach out and touch him. And they had mapped the contours of the spaceship to the contours of the room. So you could touch the wall, you could touch the seats. And at a certain point, you know, a door slides open and you walk into what must be a maze, you know, as you go into the fortress and come out. And for those, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, you know, we, all four of us, bought in quite completely. You know, that my son's friend was afraid to cross this drawbridge that was led us over lava. You know, we had this little mission that we were on, and at the end, you know, we escaped and took everything off. But I mean, the way you're talking about going back in to do it correctly, there were many challenges that took us a while to figure out that if we were to return, we would do a little better. We would know where we had went wrong. We would be able to learn from it and, you know, perfect our trip in.
Well, there's a model that I've been exploring a little bit recently in my writing, particularly the correlation between consciousness and movies and what movies are, why they might have this appeal. It's to do with how the frontal lobe of the brain, which is where apparently autonomous thinking comes from, one of its functions is to imagine scenarios in order to test out whether this is whether they're safe or not. So, yeah, so it's like we create this virtual realm and then we send an avatar of ourselves into it to test out these possible scenarios.
And well, exactly. It's interesting because I was reading a screenplay, a how to write a screenplay book recently. And, you know, I forget the title of it, but the whole conceit was that storytelling going back to, you know, the days of cave paintings was a way to run a simulation. You know, how do you pass on, you know, what you've learned about hunting a woolly mammoth? It's what you tell a story about it. And by telling the story to younger people or peers, they acquire that skill without actually having to risk their lives in a savage, you know, encounter with a deadly animal. They virtually live it alongside of you, alongside of the story that you told. And that, you know, for a lot of people, reading stories, you know, living, playing video games are ways to practice things with lower stakes, and less danger to themselves.
So I suppose one of the things that we're seeing happening is that the virtual scenarios we're enacting, I suppose, are becoming more and more fantastic. And part of that is that they're becoming less, they have less and less of a reference point to reality. I mean, the things that we learn in video games or a Marvel movie, they're more and more escapist, I guess is what I'm saying, and it's harder and harder to actually apply them to existence.
I'd say that's true. If they were originally there to teach you a set of skills, I'm not exactly sure what I learned from watching, you know, Avengers Endgame. Perhaps some interpersonal skills.
Well, one thing that's happening is that the science is attempting to imitate these fantasy narratives. So there are, whether there's any basis in reality or not, there's more and more sort of soft science or quasi science about how we can all be superheroes, how we can develop our powers, and how we can use the technology to actually make these fantasies real. So I suppose that's this weird symbiosis that I'm trying to explore now, is between, how we use the technology initially to better navigate reality, but then at a certain point it becomes we're using the technology to transform reality and to transform ourselves.
No, that's true. I mean, I might also, as I think about it now, suspect that part of the audience of, you know, this thrilling story of, you know, hunting the mammoth, some of them just enjoyed it. Some of them may, you know, have gone on to become, you know, shaman or fruit gatherers or whatever other roles they had to play. Nonetheless, they may have enjoyed listening to that story, even if they didn't necessarily have to take it as a tutorial.
Right, yeah, again, escapist thing. So, how much have you been kind of exploring, if at all, the question of, or the degree to which the simulation theory, I guess I want to ask you about specifics, but I'll just carry on with this question, is more general,
Okay.
is an updating of more ancient beliefs that's been updated by the technology. As in, now we have a technology to understand or to interpret something to do with that reality is not what we think it is, that there's a kind of manufactured aspect to reality or a deceptive aspect to reality. That belief goes back, probably goes back a long, long way, but currently we have technology to kind of explain it on a purely technological basis. So, have you explored that at all in
Oh
terms of?
yeah, absolutely. There's conversations in there, you know, where, you know, Descartes comes up or Plato's theory of the cave, you know,
Right.
sort of explicitly putting out the idea that there have been previous non-technological models for the idea that the world is a simulation. And actually, there was a really interesting idea that we kind of bumped up to in one of the later ones, which is, you know, even if you reject all that, you know, and if you come to the firm belief that this is the one and only, you know, real world, make of it what you will, that we're still experiencing it as a simulation of in a way, you know, that as we're processing, you know, our sensory organs, you know, it's, I'm creating one 3D picture from a pair of eyes. You know, I'm placing sound in three-dimensional space through two ears, and all of that is ultimately just electrical impulses that are being, you know, fed into my brain that creates a model best it can from that data. You know, it's, I'm not looking through a clear glass window at an objective reality outside of my head. It is a 3D model that's very good, that's mapped very closely to what's around me. But, you know, I'm not necessarily seeing things exactly as they are. But this is the way that, you know, my senses, you know, my mind creates the reality around me that, that I'm able to navigate around. You know, I came across an article that was, you know, beyond my capabilities to really understand on a scientific level, but something suggesting that the world is not actually in three dimensions. That in some ways it might be seen as only as existing only in two dimensions, but that the three-dimensional model that my mind creates is a more useful one, you know, for me to navigate through this life.
Right. Well, I think when you interviewed me, I think, didn't I talk about intense world syndrome a bit?
I don't know if that phrase isn't ringing a bell.
I thought
intense
I had.
Intense world?
Intense world syndrome. It's one theory of autism that I think is a good one, and that's, it relates to synesthesia as well, and that, that if we, and perhaps we all do as infants, as babies, but certainly to the extent that, and this may be true of some autistics and why they can't communicate their experience, we're experiencing reality unfiltered, then it would be a completely different experience. So, you know, the brain and the body, even, as you're saying, filters out experience and compartmentalizes it and creates this 3D model, let's say, and then it interacts with that. Whereas the intense world syndrome is the theory that before we develop that tool set, we're just getting a full inflow of information. So synesthesia is one way to maybe describe that, as in all the senses, all the sensory data is just coming in as one chunk of information, and we haven't even learnt to pass it out between sound, visual, smell, sensation. It's just all one block of intensity.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to describe it. I know I've been struggling to find a way to talk about, I mean, to me, the idea that I've heard that there are Silicon Valley geniuses working on ways to bust us out of the matrix.
Right.
But, you know, I wonder if that's not as bad of an idea as a way of reducing each of your senses to their, you know, component parts, basically to create that state that you're talking about, that if I'm able to, you know, reduce, if I'm able to fragment my senses into the raw data, without constructing the world around me, it's not going to be a very helpful state to be in.
Certainly, if you weren't prepared. I mean, one would have to deduce there's a reason why we've learned this. And there's a reason, even if you associate with fragmentation, which is an effect of trauma, that's still a survival mechanism. Right? We have to develop coping mechanisms to deal with trauma, with overwhelming experience, and we compartmentalize, and it becomes a defense, right? So although it might imprison us, there's still a reason why we develop that. So if you would just dismantle it willy-nilly, it might be worse in the matrix as well. Like, you can't unplug people after a certain age because they can't handle it, right?
Exactly.
So did you consider, or have you considered, I mean, there's an obvious correlation here when talking about what we're talking about now, I think, with spiritual models about enlightenment, as in reaching a state of perceiving reality directly rather than simply just relating to our own mental interpretations. Did you consider trying to find somebody who might actually have attained that state and see what they had to say?
I don't know that I have. And I think there was in an email you were hinting that you might know somebody.
I was hinting, and that wasn't what motivated this question now, actually, but it just came up organically. Yeah,
but, you know, I haven't necessarily been aware of anyone who has broken out of the matrix, you know, in any concrete way, you know, other than, you know, folks who are, you know, online talking about having, you know, thrown off the shackles of, you know, of conventional ideas, say. But, you know, people talking, I haven't come across anyone talking about it in a real concrete way. Be fascinated to see where they were coming from with that.
Right. Well, so you mean talk concretely about getting free of the simulation, but I mean, they might not talk about it in those terms, of course. But I was just wondering, now that we're talking about the correlation between, at least as a thought exercise, if we're entertaining the idea that we are in some sense imprisoned in a false reality, then are the people who've escaped, what would it look like? What would they testify to? An obvious place to go, even though I'd say it's also a place not to want to go because it's full of charlatans, would be the, you know, the spiritual marketplace where people are claiming to be enlightened. I mean, there's hundreds of them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've certainly talked to, you know, besides yourself, I talked to Eric Davis, who had, you know, a lot of interesting things to talk about as far as putting the matrix in context with philosophical and religious notions. A lot of what we talked about, you know, was Philip K. Dick, because he did his work on the exegesis, and, you know, PKD is certainly, you know, a founding father of simulation theory in a lot of ways. So I don't know that there is a shortage of philosophical religious avenues, you know, that the conversations we've been doing, you know, haven't explored.
Right. Well, psychedelics as well, of course.
Yeah.
Did you talk to people about psychedelics much?
Not much. I mean, the core of it, you know, were people who have had very intense, you know, firsthand experiences that on the other end of left them believing that we're in a technological style simulation. And then from there, you know, there's 100 digressions based on things that come up in those conversations.
Hmm. How many people did you speak to in the end?
So far, I think we've done 14, and there's maybe 2 or 3 to go.
Okay, so, and how many volunteers did you get?
I would probably have about 30 or 40, and from them, I think I picked, you know, the eight to 10 kind of most provocative from what they wrote.
Right.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing where I know I'm never going to be able to, I can barely get every idea that I find, you know, kind of new and interesting into it. So this, I don't have the hubris to think that this project is going to be the defining document on, you know, simulation theory so much as a portrait of some people who've had really interesting experiences and who's meditating on them have come up with you know, really kind of powerful things to say about it.
And how many people, I'm assuming there were some, did you speak to who seemed to literally believe in simulation theory?
I don't know, at least a half dozen.
Who literally believe, or who believe that we are literally inside a computer simulation?
Exactly. Although even they, you know, I think most everyone, you know, always says, I'm not necessarily speaking with 100% certainty, but this is what makes the most sense to me based on my firsthand experience and, you know, whatever other research that I've done. No, I don't have any hardcore, you know, simulation evangelists, I don't think. Most everyone gives themselves a little bit of wiggle room because, you know, it's a pretty gigantic idea at the end of the day. You know, and unless you have literally come out of the pod and then made yourself and then were able to make your way back in to talk about it,
right.
Your certainty is going to be less than 100%.
Right. Well, because some people feel like they've had that experience. I suppose I do in a certain sense via psychedelics and dreams.
Mm-hmm.
But then I never felt that it was a literal technologically generated simulation.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of the technological ideas come from, you know, Bostrom's, you know, paper and that sort of three-part logic, three-part kind of logic puzzle that he made. Mm-hmm. That either, you know, we're doomed to die out before we hit the level where we can make simulations, that civilizations like ours, that civilizations that get to the level to make them don't make them for some reason, or if they make them, you know, and they make more than one, statistics say that we're probably in one. And I think, and that's an idea that I know has captured a lot of people's imaginations, because it's pretty hard to refute that one of those three is true, but, you know, the first one is just as easy as the last.
Yeah, for sure. Did you try and talk to Boston?
I have talked to him.
He did.
You know, it's funny. It's funny that you brought up Groundhog Day, because I think the part of the conversation that surprised me the most was, you know, that was sort of the fictional, that was the film that most captivated him as far as a way to talk about the ideas, more than The Matrix or Existence or The 13th Floor or any other films that are more literally discussing simulation theory. And I was excited to be able to tell him about movies like Edge of Tomorrow or Happy Death Day that take the same, that work on the same principle.
Right. Wonder if he knows Peake's work. So is he going to be in the film then, Boston?
Probably. You know, it's for me, going to, you know, that sort of expert witness is a little outside of the way I typically do it, which is first-hand experience versus, you know, sort of a academic researcher. But there may be ways to work him in as a special guest alongside of a core cast who have, you know, kind of longer personal stories.
It's paradise to have and to hold.
It's interesting you mentioned Eric Davis because I've just put up a podcast with him, so I've
Oh, cool. He's great.
just spoken to him, and I was listening to one of his shows from a while back, talking to a guy called I think he's called Alan Greenfield. He wrote a book called Radical Technology, and they were talking about the Internet of Things, which I guess you know about, this coming smart planet, essentially, where everything's going to, all the different appliances are going to be hooked up to each other. And yeah, exactly. And I thought Eric made a very interesting observation, or between them they did, because in the book, one of the things he talks about is there's a mood to this technological kind of embeddedness that we're experiencing now, and it's a mood of sadness and melancholy. And Eric Davis spoke about this, that he just touched on it very briefly, but he compared, you know, the world now to the world when he grew up as a child, and how, you know, we'd move through the world and there'd be this constant experience of being in between different places and different experiences. You can even say it's liminal space in which we weren't under surveillance, we weren't using technology. There was just that feeling of a kind of organic spontaneity and of mystery and of unknown. He didn't unpack it, but I'm doing that now. That there's a real richness in that feeling of really not kind of knowing where you are or where you're going, and just Tim Winnie the Pooh, actually, is the thing he says about what's he saying, Winnie the Pooh? What are you doing? What are you up to, Pooh? And he says, oh, nothing. And he goes, oh, that's my favorite thing, you know, just doing nothing. And I think there is something that we've lost. It's just this, I suppose it relates to organic existence, in which we're not always plugged into some kind of agenda. We have these spaces in which we just are kind of waiting and just exploring and seeing what's going to come up, you know, what our instincts or our intuitions or impulses are going to surprise us with next. And that's particularly true when we're children and we're in that state. But I think it's also, like, collectively, the world has become more and more closed down in this way, because it's become more and more embedded in this superstructure of technology. And technology always has a purpose, it always has a function. So it's like we become an extension of that. So I think they were hitting on something now, that there's this kind of sadness and even despair that's growing in our world that can be mapped onto the technology itself. So I'm wondering, did you notice anything like that when you were talking to people? Did you notice any kind of particular mood or the correlation between what people believed and how they seemed to be in themselves, you know, emotionally?
Well, there is a melancholy to a lot of it, though. In a very interesting way, there was a virtual reality designer artist that I spoke to, who was one of the people who felt, there was, I think, an irony for me, that on the one hand, she seemed to she had the least amount of belief in simulation theory, but from many people's points of view, she looks like a person who may well be helping the simulation come together as she's advancing the technology that could at some point become the simulation. Right. But, you know, the idea of it really left her cold, as far as, you know, putting a line between the natural world and herself, via the exploration of the body. You know, and I get what you're saying, and I feel the same way. You know, probably, you know, very strongly, because, you know, I have a kid who's, I'm always trying to chase him off of the iPad. But it's also hard to say how much of it isn't simply nostalgia. You know, I grew up, and, you know, I spent a lot of time. I was able to explore the woods pretty freely, but I also spent a lot of time in front of the television. And I know that in the 70s, when I was young, when I was a kid, you know, kids had much more freedom to go off and explore. People are, 100 times more protected these days. Mm-hmm. I saw a very powerful diagram years ago, and it's probably, been updated since then, that talked about the amount of area that a child was allowed to roam over the, over the ages, and that in the 1800s, they could go 2 or 3 miles away from their home at a time, and in the 70s, it shrunk down to, 200 yards, and now it's about 10 feet from a adult that you're allowed to explore on your own.
Right. Well, one thing has occurred to me very recently, and even in the course of this conversation, is the question of to what extent might we be creating a simulated reality, but not in the way that we've understood that term, like virtual reality, simulated reality. The idea is you actually create a computer-generated reality and then project your consciousness into it by whatever means. But what if we're, as well as doing that, but maybe that's a kind of red herring, because maybe the simulated reality we're creating has more to do with creating more and more filters in this physical reality between us and nature via the technology, which itself not only is becoming more and more proliferate, but it's also becoming more and more animated in a certain sense with the Internet of Things. It's all interconnected and we're more and more dependent on it. And then we've got the 5G, which is beaming these microwaves to the whole planet, all the satellites and so on. So have you considered this, that we may be actually be creating a kind of simulated reality that isn't literally separate from the natural world, but is kind of superimposed on it and then creates this matrix around us energetically?
Well, certainly, I've noticed, from, seeing, a navigation map within a car, that there is a digital map of the world that is exactly the same size as the world, but only visible through this special screen. It's very much, the conceit of the map and the territory.
Yeah.
It isn't paper, it's in the ether. The right. Same way, that with, if you've ever played Pokemon Go, that holding the phone up and they superimpose the characters, into the world, they're mapped three-dimensionally into the world around you. And you hold up your phone and you can see, oh, there's a Pokemon on top of that newspaper box. We're hiding behind that garbage can. And
yeah.
They appear on a map that's superimposed to like a Google map, of the city, the state, the neighborhood, the world, and somewhere there's a computer database keeping track of where all of the Pokemon are on planet Earth, and they're only visible through, not that they live glasses, but, your iPhone, your Android. There is very much already an invisible virtual world superimposed on top of ours,
right.
Only visible to people who have the right, technology installed.
Right.
Maybe not exactly what you're talking about, but something that I found, kind of striking.
Yeah, no, I think that is what I'm talking about. And I can't remember if last time we spoke if I mentioned this, but I might have done, but that in Germany, apparently, check this, but I have heard that they now have painted on the sidewalk like lines for people to follow, and that they've put protective cushioning around lampposts so that people don't have to look up, and if they do still bump into lampposts, they won't harm themselves too much because they're
addictedly scrolling.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing I've noticed, and I'm as addicted to my Twitter feed as anyone. I reflexively go to it when I have, it isn't a half hour free. It's if I have 17 seconds free, I'll boot it up and have to fill in that time. But I never realized, how boring it was to walk, 40 feet down a corridor, without taking a break to see what's happened to politics since I left the room.
Right. So, but that's not boring, is it? I mean, that's not boredom. Or at least if it is, that's a whole new kind of boredom because it's related to FOMO as well, the fear of missing out. It's not just that we feel bored, we feel anxious because we think we should be checking in with the global village and keeping up.
That might be a better way to describe it, but I certainly get anxious, and I also get that little endorphin rush when there's a bunch of good ones waiting for me in there that since the last time I checked.
Yeah, well, I was just in my garden with my cat, and I didn't. My cat had laid down on my leg, and also my cat doesn't stay in the garden for long. He's male and he's not been neutered, so he goes roaming, and he will stay in the garden if I'm there. So I knew that if I went to get my laptop, he might leave even in that short period of time. And so I just reminded myself, well, look. Surrounded by mountains, it's beautiful sun, it's warm. I got my cat, my companion, lying on a rug in the garden. Once upon a time, this would have been the optimal conditions for me. Yes, I might have wanted a book, but still, the fact is, I was thinking, Andy, I've only got 40 minutes to talk to Rodney, I should be checking my email, blah, blah, blah. I had to talk myself out of that. I did get my laptop in the end, but I at least waited 20 minutes or so and just, I really had to override. The programming, I'd say it is a kind of programming because it was telling me something I knew wasn't true. Like
Whether
I.
it's programming or an addiction, it's an incredibly powerful compulsion, and I can't fight it better than most people. I mean, I'm not, and I think it's really hitting a level for me that it's starting to, be very, very disruptive, very unhelpful. That I'm trying to work, I'm trying to edit the film or to write somebody or to, take care of some other task, and have to fight an incredibly powerful temptation to open up a window on another screen next door and check in the meantime. Distracting me from things that are supposed to be the most important thing, that I have in front of me.
Yeah, well, we're getting more and more used to having our consciousness divided, aren't we? Rather than being focused on one thing.
Well, Eric talked about that when we spoke, in a way, and compared it to Philip K. Dick, of a world which you're surrounded by 1,000 hungry prompts, tap dancing to try to get your attention.
Right.
I think in particular he was talking about Palmer Eldritch and like the credits he needed to leave the apartment, that everywhere you go, there's a little window you need to click on, a prompt that you have to respond to, and how fragmenting it can be to live surrounded by those.
Did you read Palmer Eldritch recently, or was it?
I probably read it in 2 or 3 months ago.
Because that question came up in the conversation I had with Gib. He wondered if you'd read it, and I just recently reread it because I thought it might have some clues in it. I mean, all of Dick has clues in it.
That's a powerful one, though. I mean, I think my favorite is still Flow My Tears.
That's my favorite too. Well, one of the things with Dick is that, or with that book particularly, I suppose, is that, but it's throughout his work, I suppose, is the interest in mind-altering drugs as a metaphor. Like he needs a device within his fiction to make plausible this, the creation of and entering into surrogate realities. And so he, in Palmer Eldritch at least, but other works as well, he uses drugs to do so. And although they are part of our techno simulated reality now, even especially with Silicon Valley and all the psychedelic use, it's clear that whatever's going on now is a lot more complex than simply taking a drug. And drug is more of a metaphor for that. It's as though the technology itself and the world itself is altering our consciousness more and more. The same, we're becoming more and more lost, potentially, I would say. I don't want to be dystopian, but I am, so I can't pretend not to be. More and more lost in this surrogate reality, in which, and I think one of the factors that's key is that we're letting the technology make our choices for us. So you're talking about the Pokemon and the GPS. That thing about the map is interesting because the whole idea of a map that's as big as the territory was kind of an absurd thing initially, like it was a joke or an idea that presented as an example of something that would be absurd. Like if you wanted to create a map that was absolutely accurate, it would have to be as large as the territory, and therefore you wouldn't be able to unroll it. You wouldn't be able to use it. It would be useless. And yet we have come up with technologies, you say, where we can do that.
The only problem is paper. It's not the
Yeah,
right medium.
that's right. We found a new medium.
I mean, if anything, our present day shows that satire is not up to the job
Right.
of exaggerating, how drastic things can get.
Yeah.
People did. There was a lot of when Trump's Access Hollywood tape came out. There was a lot of comparisons between that moment and the climax of that Andy Griffith movie. Where he was a political player in a 1950s movie.
Oh, Face in the Crowd.
Thanks to the crowd, where he's ultimately undone by a recording of him at his worst being made public. The
Right,
same
right.
thing in Batman Returns. Of course, in those satires, that was the end. But in reality, things worked out differently. That the most the broadest satires people try to come up with have a way of falling short these days.
there was a Freudian theory that he talked about, which is that because of trauma in early years, we get implanted with like body memories of traumatic experiences, and because that trauma is unresolved, what he theorized or apparently observed in his patients is that we're compulsively reenacting those scenarios that traumatized us just below the threshold of consciousness as an attempt to resolve them. And this can actually lead, or does actually lead, to physical reenactments, as in when we keep getting into a relationship with the same kind of person who's abusive to us, and why do we keep entering, you know, or our addiction or alcoholism, we keep repeating the same mistakes even though we know we shouldn't. Freud would have said, well, that is an unconscious reenactment compulsion. We're trying to resolve something that we couldn't resolve at the time because we were children. And that part of this is that we're, even when we're not physically reenacting it, we're mentally reenacting it again. I guess maybe the frontal lobe, or maybe deeper in the brain, we're replaying these images in our consciousness constantly, like we're dreaming awake. And it's happening so fast and so unconscious that we're not aware of it. But because of that, we're not really able to relate to or respond to what's happening in the present.
It's funny, this thing that sounds an awful lot like the virtual reality scenario we were talking about.
Exactly.
At the beginning of the conversation, where you live the life and again and again and again, trying to get it right, the Groundhog Day scenario.
Yeah, and also that we're not really able to be in this reality because our consciousness is trapped in another reality. That's also part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't even have to be a buried childhood memory. I know sometimes when I'm just deeply in conflict, there's nothing else I can think. I can't see, you know, 4 feet in front of me because I'm having imaginary conversations with people who've done me wrong.
Yeah, right. So we're all familiar with it, but I think probably the deepest imprints are the ones that we're not conscious of.
Yeah, well, in childhood experiences, you know, I know as I get older, I'm struck by how short childhood actually is, but in my mind's eye, you know, it looms so large. You know, I just revisited, you know, the house that I lived in from, you know, when I was born till I was about 13. And, you know, it has legendary status in my lifetime, but I've lived in the house I'm in now for at least as long, and in an apartment I rented in San Francisco half as long, and it doesn't have nearly the power.
Mm. Have you found talking to these different people about their experiences? I mean, clearly there's a personal aspect. They are testifying to the personal experiences, and that's, as you said, that's been your interest generally as a documentary filmmaker. You don't so much want to go to experts and have some academic theory. You want to go to just regular people and get a sense of their lived experience, and your films have been very effective, I think, in representing that. Like I said to you when we first spoke, I think that for you, your Room 237 humanized The Shining for me. It actually made me aware of a much more human element to that via being able to see it through other people's eyes and their personal relationship to it. So have you found with your work in general, but specifically with this latest one, that there's something, I don't want to say therapeutic, but just personally helpful or nourishing for you to connect to other people and explore some mystery together like that?
A little bit. You know, I think in general, the folks that I talk to in any of these projects have experiences that are similar to mine, but maybe more intense, more dramatic, more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks that I've talked to, you know, have these defining childhood moments where something happens and they kind of are struck by the fact that the world is not necessarily what they thought it was. And I had a really, I there's a moment that I always go back to from when I was in elementary school. which again, it's not as profound as anything they felt, but I had a very powerful sense of time slipping past me. And that as significant and as intense as my school days experiences were, that at one point, they would all disappear in a blur as I got older. And I made this really powerful, focused effort just to remember this one moment that I was experiencing at that time as that thought occurred to me as I was walking up an echoey staircase, turning on the landing and heading back up the other way. And despite all odds, I have been able to preserve it. I was able to put a pin in it in that moment and, sort of record it in full audio visual fidelity. And, I don't know that it means an awful lot, but it's a memory that when I go back to, I feel like a rush of emotion surrounding it. And when I come across folks who have similar stories, and theirs are often more dramatic, you were telling me about your experience, at the, going to the Hall of Fair, that strikes a chord. And I'm not necessarily sure of what it means, but I know that it's something that I want to talk about, spend a minute thinking about.
When you made Room 237 and when you said you started the project, I'm guessing you weren't obsessed with The Shining yourself.
I was a fan of The Shining. I was a fan. I was not obsessed in the way that people I talked to were obsessed. No. Though I did find although The Shining is to me and has always been more than just another movie. Something, there is a uncanny aspect to it. The symmetry, the music, the simplicity of the story, the strange repetitive structure. And I know every time I watch it, I try to find them. It never quite resolved for me fully. The story never quite, it doesn't deliver as catharsis. It doesn't deliver as a narrative with a great button on it or a rosebud type ending that makes everything fall into perspective. I was kind of remained sort of a mystery. And I know when the half dozen times I watched it before, or maybe I watched it 10 times before I began 237, I was intrigued by the mystery and I did want to pay attention to try to find the moment in which it fell apart. I would say fell apart, not in a bad way, like it broke, but more like it sort of dissolved to abstraction. It was zoomed in close enough that it turned into dots. So I'm very interested in The Shining and, all the Kubrick films, but no, it wasn't a level of obsession that was anything near, like what the people I spoke to experienced.
Well, you don't strike me as an obsessive type, actually.
I don't know. Between, of course, our standards are different than others. We all consider ourselves, the yardstick for normalcy. So, I think anybody more obsessive than me is obsessive, and anyone less is not.
Sure, and. Okay, well, I don't consider myself an obsessive type, but I know that in other people's eyes I am, and I can accept that. I don't consider obsession to be healthy anyway, by the way, so there's no need to feel bad if I just accused you of not being obsessive, but...
I've been accused of worse.
So, yeah, right. But no, I'm just curious, kind of what drives you into these areas, because you are exploring personal obsessions, I would say. Well, certainly Room 237, let's go to The Nightmare. That's not so much personal obsession, but people who are having experiences that would be very hard not to obsess over because they're so intense. Again, you didn't have experiences of sleep paralysis yourself particularly.
No, I had one very dramatic experience of sleep paralysis that I was sure was a supernatural experience at the time it happened to me.
Okay, so I forgot that. So that would have been the in for you then. There was something, there was an anomaly or something unresolved in your own life. So.
Well, I don't necessarily feel that it was unresolved. You know, as I read the, I years later, I came across the psychological, you know, medical sort of explanation for it, and that kind of popped that bubble, and I went on with my life happy that, you know, I wasn't being menaced by demons, that I just had a strange, you know, hallucination, sleep experience. But years later, I came across accounts of people describing their experiences, and it came back to me just how powerful it was. And I think my own experience, if nothing else, was gave me the confidence that this is real, that these folks, you know, are not making it up. They're not exaggerating what they've gone through. It allowed it, when I was filming the recreations, it informed my judgment about how far to go with what this experience might look or feel like. You know, and then as I got into the weeds of it, there were mysteries that were kind of unresolvable. But I had mostly moved on in my life. I think my experience with it was mostly just a just informed the idea that this is something that was very real and very interesting and strangely under discussed.
And was it cathartic for you to revisit it? Did you find yourself revisiting the experience in your own life by making the film?
Not it would be a better story if I said yes.
Yeah.
But I had basically moved on, and it happened once or twice while I was making the film, and it wasn't at all upsetting because I knew what it was, and I was sort of just wanted to be present to observe it as research.
Was that unusual, though, that it was
It
happening?
was, it was, and it's kind of one of the, you know, and I'd say getting back into it, there are mysteries that are hard for me to resolve about sleep paralysis, but you know, this world is full of unresolved mysteries for me, and I can make peace and go on that way. The fact that it happened twice while I was spending such a long time thinking about it so actively is strange, you know. and I don't necessarily have a great explanation for why it happened. But it wasn't nearly as troubling, as upsetting, as frightening as it was, you know, when it came out of the blue.
So it was demon free that these
It
were
was
your
demon-free.
experience.
It was more of a, it was a psychedelic experience.
Psychedelic.
Yeah, it was a, it was a laser light show, you know. It wasn't a sinister visitation.
Have you had out of body experiences?
I never have. And before I interviewed people for the film, it was news to me that those things were related.
Yeah.
But I have since, you know, I've since found out how common that linking is.
Yeah, I just did a podcast actually with someone who whose sleep paralysis experiences led to out of body experiences, and then that led to kind of alien abduction type experiences, encounters with entities that were like aliens. So there's definitely a spectrum there. I was also thinking that maybe this might be a reach, but you can say so if it is. There could be a spectrum or a continuum rather between your film projects. I just found out actually about another one that I didn't even know about, the Il Duce Papers, but the ones that I was aware of, the Room 237, The Nightmare, and now Glitch in the Matrix. There could be a continuum there that relates to the afterlife.
Well, certainly this new one discusses it directly, and I suppose, you know, The Nightmare spoke a fair amount about it.
And The Shining, of
Yeah,
course,
well,
because
sure. Well, in The Shining, you know, it was while working on The Nightmare, I realized that, you know, Danny was undergoing a lot of experiences that looked a lot like sleep paralysis, or moments of him terrorized in bed, seemingly unable to move, seeing visions, hearing things. Well, it's funny. I know, like, part of the process of this one, too, is trying to come up with a creative strategy that would suit the material. And in many ways, the structure is similar to the last two. But, it's also, there are ways that it's been put together that I like to think is very different. But there's a strange thing about the patterns of what you do or the ideas that you get attracted to, that the first couple happen spontaneously, but then there's a danger or an attraction about going back and asking, well, what is it that I do? What is it that I'm interested in? And rewatching, older projects and cribbing from them in a way and saying, this is what I've done in the past, so this is what I must be doing. This must be what I do, and let me learn from it, even though you didn't have a model or I didn't have a model in the first couple. I'm looking at 237 or The Nightmare as a model for this and questioning, do I need to be consistent? Do I need to be consistent with that, with that strategy?
Right.
It can be, sometimes it's helpful, other times not. It's something I didn't have to wrestle with before.
Well, it's making me think of the last three books I wrote, because by the time I was writing the third, I think I realized or decided that it was really a trilogy, because there was a theme to all the books, which I'd say is kind of sociocultural engineering. Well, actually, I've reframed that now. I call them my disillusionment trilogy. So first of all, I was looking at movies and seen and not seen, and then Prisoner Infinity, I was looking at UFO stuff and New Age, spirituality, and then in Vice of Kings, I was looking at organized sexual abuse in relation to occultism and to my family background and so on. So with each book, I was kind of peeling more layers away. But I was also, like, the methodology I discovered with seen and not seen, which was sort of using the culture as a mirror for my own internal conditioning and vice versa, looking at my internal programming as a way to better understand what's going on in the world. That methodology I developed through the subsequent books. So now I can see them, they're all a continuum, like me just trying to work something out through various iterations. So.
Yeah, well, I very much see this one as the third part of the trilogy, that hopefully the final part, and then it can move on to something completely unrelated. With the El Duce tapes being a side project that has a couple things in common, but in other ways is very different. That's the one where, and I had a co-director partner with that, where we were working with footage that was shot in 1990 of one of the most outrageous, offensive, and kind of punk rock metal performers in Los Angeles, and a friend of Tim Kirker, guy who I've worked with forever and who's produced most of these things, shot that footage back in the day, and we went over it and found a really interesting character and story kind of in the tapes. And it looks much, much different from any of these. I mean, it's got a very lo-fi VHS, sort of sensibility. Mm. But we get conceptual with the VHS-ness of it, and the graphics trying to make it look like this is a movie that was sort of discovered in a Goodwill in 1995 with a handwritten label on it. But it also gets into questions that probably don't have anything to do. I don't think there's any overlap between El Duce and The Nightmare or Glitch in the Matrix, but like Room 237, it talks a lot about, the nature of art, because, this it's about the creative process and about this guy who went through a lot of hell as a kid making a very hellish sort of music, and whether it was therapeutic for him, what its effect might be on the audience. And he come and without giving away spoilers this punk rock VHS doc, you know, there's also questions in it about certainly the things he did and said on stage, you know, were pretty bad, pretty terrible by the standards of the day, let alone today where it's much, much worse. Mm. But, you know, compared to things that, you know, his father, who was a military contractor, did, you know, how bad is really to say terrible things on stage versus, you know, designing a bomb to deliver napalm to, you know, a village in rural Vietnam. So that one looks very different, but I can see it as this is a neater trilogy, for whatever purpose that might serve, than the LGBT case, but it's tangential. It overlaps some.
Compromise of the spirit, you know just what you're gonna forego. All inside, on the hardened floor of the highway, where I find I can't give. Hard inside, till the bliss like a spool rushes through me from the imaginary source. Stay with me. Hold me up. Make me see. Hold me up. Make from the heart of the light, joy came. Imaginary heart, imaginary joy. Well, I need a reference from my dearest friend. Hell's heart in the light of the lonely one. Hell's fame across the Neverland. My foil is the world I'm used to. My toil is its consequence.
How would you describe the consistent theme of this loose trilogy then? What makes them a trilogy?
Well, they're about interpretation. They're about people trying to answer puzzles, mm-hmm. you know, in puzzles of increasing complexity. What is this movie about? / what is, you know, what is this particular movie about versus, as well as, you know, who owns the ideas in a piece of art, the artist or the audience?
Hmm.
You know, the nightmares about, you know, people who go through this strange supernatural experience trying to understand what's happened to them, you know, and also whether these things that you see, are they things that come from are they something external to them that is real but usually invisible, or is it something that's projected from inside?
Mm,
yeah. You know, and then this one is in a similar way, you know, talking about what's all of this stuff, what's everything around us.
Yeah, right. So it's subjectivity, isn't it? The power of subjectivity and the limits, or if there are limits. The whole postmodernist thing, that, I mean, we're in this post-postmodernist world now where the idea of objective reality itself has come under question, or even is considered politically incorrect, weirdly.
And they're much more about the questions than about the answers. You know, none of them, I think, end on the first two don't end on definitive notes, and I'll be astonished if this one does.
One question I would have had, or would have, I don't know if you did, was if people believe they're in the simulation theory, do they believe that they're interacting, when they're interacting with other people, do they believe they're interacting with actual sentient people, or do they believe they're acting with non-player characters?
That's a very big part of what I have so far, and of whether you're the only person in the matrix, whether there's a small handful of quote-unquote real people, whether we're all AIs or whether we're all avatars for external slash real characters. That's something people spend a lot of time wrestling with.
Mm-hmm.
In the conversations I've had.
Right. Another thing occurred to me, or talking to you, is that there's a lot of seemingly respectable, thoughtful people, I don't know about a lot, but there's a few that are proposing this theory, like Nick Bostrom. But it's kind of the ultimate conspiracy theory, and even beyond that, it's the ultimate sort of metaphysical idea, even if it's not metaphysically based. So I wonder what people of this kind, or what some of them might say if you suggested, well, I think the moon landing was faked, or we're living on a flat earth, would they come back and say, that's ridiculous? or does this open their minds to every other possibility? Because if we're living in a simulation, well, all bets are off. No?
Well, you know, one interesting idea that I think two people have had, if memory serves, is that the idea that it's a simulation could lead to the rules changing as we go along, that like a video game, we can be living in at a certain point, the world can be updated and the variables can be changed, which is certainly something that Philip K. Dick talked about. But there, you know, there's some maybe giant, you know, the early passages of the Bible, there's talks, there's mentions of giants. Maybe in the Matrix 1.0 there were giants. And as it gets updated and we get pushed along into the newer versions, you know, things have changed.
Right.
Maybe the moon landing was real in one iteration and it was in another. You know, people talk about an infinite number of simulations being made in order to test variables. You know, so I think there's every reason to believe that different versions of it would work out differently. I know one thing that Bostrom said that surprised me, because he's always used the term ancestor simulation, which is to suggest that the people from the future who built this matrix have recreated the past exactly as it was. And to me, that seemed just unthinkably impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody in 1,000 years could know what's on my desk today, but that information, there's no way that information could be preserved by any technology,
mm-hmm.
unless you perhaps go back to the Big Bang and then the chain reaction works out identically,
or hack into the DNA, perhaps this genetic memory
of this haphazard collection of Legos on my desk.
Well, you know, say if they say if they hypnotize you, you will be able to recount every single detail, you know, of the last 24 hours or whatever. So,
if the real world is 1,000 years in the future and I'm long since dead, how they could recreate me exactly as I was seemed an insurmountable problem from my puny estimation.
I would agree. Yeah, did he have an answer for that?
He said that's not necessarily what it is, that they could have just, that it might just be more people of the sort that were around back then, which for some reason was much looser than my imagination.
That's a lot looser, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that he was talking, I thought when he said ancestor simulation that that meant this is exactly the world of the past, from the point of view of the simulators. Mm. Of course, you know, he's, you know, like he hedges his bets a lot. He, just as far as to say, this is a logic problem. I'm not arguing that we are in the Matrix, and I'm certainly and I certainly wouldn't go on to say what it's like outside, who is doing it, and to what end. You know, would be completely outside of his, you know, his capability to estimate from his perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly from mine.
beyond his pay grade.
Yeah.
Hmm. Did you, I know you and I talked about it a bit, but did you get into with anyone else the psychological elements of it? I don't mean as an explanation, but derealization, depersonalization, a feeling of unreality, a sense of alienation, despair, again, melancholy. Was that part of any of the conversations?
It was. And there was a guy who had a childhood experience that I found very moving and a little frightening, which was that he had this conviction that after he would walk past people, after they would get out of his sight, that they would just sort of face a wall and stand motionless until they were needed again.
Mm, wow.
Which, coincidentally or not, you know, is a way that, is something that video games, that highly complicated video games do in order to save processing power. You know, the non-player characters, once they're off the screen, often come to a halt. And there is technology, you know, for developers to record what that looks like from a point of view other than the camera point of view.
Hmm. And what about, did it extend with anyone you spoke to a kind of paranoia of not knowing who to trust or not trusting anyone, and basically feeling that everybody one interacts with is part of some malevolent deception?
No, I haven't talked to anyone who, I mean, it sounds like you're getting at something like gang stalking or they call it the Truman Syndrome, based on the Truman Show.
Truman Delusion,
The Truman Delusion. Nobody I've talked to has gotten to that place, but certainly some of them suspect that, you know, that a lot of people they encounter are quote unquote non-player characters.
Did you get the sense? What was your sense about how they experienced that? Like, was it reassuring as it made them feel superior, or was it disconcerting as it made them feel alone and alienated, or something else?
It seems closer to the front, to the former, that, you know, knowing that they are one of the authentic avatars is a little reassuring, or gives them a little freedom. But almost to a person, you know, they would say, you never can tell, so you need to treat people, assume that they are, you know, as real and as authentic as you are, whatever you might suspect, you know, about the nature of AIs or non-player characters or whatever else, you know, because the alternative, you know, is danger and madness.
True enough. Did you talk to somebody who thought that they might be an AI program?
Not exactly, but I did talk to someone who wrote an article talking about the fact that they feel like a non-player character, and that they specifically plan out their day in that way. Like this guy talked about, you know, I worked in a supermarket and I have a half dozen procedures I need to do with each customer, and I've made this simple decision tree, and I know that this decision tree is exactly like the ones that the villagers in this one video game go through, and the kinds of dialogue prompts that they give and receive. And by acting as a non-player character, I am much more efficiently navigating through my responsibilities in my life. And, you know, he took it very far. So he was a really interesting kind of comparison to someone else who wrote sort of an online strategy games with dialogue prompts for non-player characters, and while doing that, reflected on the fact that his life and most of the decisions he makes in the course of the day can be, could well be summarized, you know, with the same methodology.
Right. I wrote a script actually similar to that about a chap with an obsessive compulsive disorder taken to such a degree that he wanted to regulate his days to make them all exactly the same. So essentially he turned himself into a robot, I could describe it, or he would act like a robot because he would just follow the same behavior, you know, pre-programmed behaviors.
Well, even Ralph Nader, I think, at one point decided that he could shave some minutes of decision making off of his day by dressing the same every single day and buying multiple versions of the same clothes.
That's in Cronenberg's The Fly as well. Mm. It has that. Mm. Yeah.
I am going to have to go in just a few minutes.
Yeah, I let that pause be there because I knew I could browbeat you into staying. I got no end to the questions. Obviously, it's fascinating. There's just so many different ways to go. Well, I guess it's too late now, but I kind of wish I'd talked to you more about my paranoia, or that you'd talk to somebody who's paranoid. Because if you think of David Icke or some these kind of interpretations of reality, that they also overlap with simulation theory in a very dark way. And yeah, I do have days, or generally I do have an encroaching thing in my worldview, which is I don't know who is part of deceptive agendas, who's an intelligence operative, and so on and so forth. And that kind of paranoia, which is informed paranoia, I would say does overlap with simulation theory, because I get this sense more and more that there's an invisible world hidden behind the surface of society, which has to do with psychological operations and gang stalking, as you say, and organized crime and pedophile rings and so on and so forth. Anyway, you probably wouldn't want that in the film, because it would just make it way too dark. But no, anyway, I couldn't help but just throw that out there, because it's...
Well, I'll put a pin in it. You know, things are still in flex. You know, and from time to time, I need to take a step back and see what I have and where I need to go. But it's a bottom, like all these ideas. There, it's a bottomless pit.
Well, some more than others, and I think this one you've hit on is particularly bottomless. Like it's ultimate subjectivity, the question of that ultimate subjectivity. But I also think it's very timely, as I say, with postmodernism having taken over the universities and everything. It's a very legitimized idea. So, I think it was a good
choice. It's mine to screw up.
It's yours to screw up, did you say?
It's a good enough idea. We'll see if I'm able to do justice to it.
Well, I think if you throw a spanner in the works, it wouldn't be a bad thing anyway. People tend to over-literalize things that don't need literalizing, I think. So, it's fascinating. So I hope you find the right creative form for it. Like you say, you want to do something somewhat new, but at the same time consistent with what you've been doing. So, are you reasonably confident about that in terms of the style of it?
I think so. You know, a lot of it's going to be done. There's going to be a fair amount of animation, but like 3D animation done within VR is kind of what we're looking at now, which gets especially interesting because there can be kind of behind the scenes recordings of the animation from within the VR space. Mm. So everything is within, you know, this sort of virtual world.
Right. And is that rotoscope? Is it rotoscope's part of that?
Not rotoscope, but probably motion capture, you know, where somebody, you know, is either holding some devices or wearing like one of those rubber suits to act out the material, to act out the scenes, and it gets mapped onto these characters.
Right.
So there's a very lifelike quality, even if the characters will be fairly lo-fi and unrealistic.
Mm.
But finding the right balance is part of the challenge of this. But you know, knock on wood, I'm excited by some of the tests that we've done so far.
Mm. And what's your timeline? What's the ETA? Have you set a deadline?
I would love for it to be done by the end of the year, but it's probably not realistic. You know, hopefully, if not then hopefully by April of 2020.
You got to get it out in 2020 at least, because.
Oh God, yes. Well, I mean, I can't afford to work on it much longer than that. I'll run out of time and money.
Right. Well, it's the year for it, though. I mean, with 2020, just that meaning of that phrase. You know, it's the whole new vision is being ushered in.
That's good. I have not made the connection. That's great. Hindsight is 2020.
I hear a voice that's not my own. It tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen anymore. I won't listen anymore.
That's the end of The Liminalist for this week. Thanks for listening, and thanks for all your support. This is Jason Horsley for the podcast Between at horticulture.com/liminalist.
Swear to yours. I know they all come from long ago and only resonate now. It's hard to tell which thoughts are my own when I keep hearing everyone else. I keep hearing everyone else. I won't listen. Some point they become the family of one.